You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, research has found that the loss or gain of an hour around daylight savings time can have a big impact on our health. We'll talk to a biologist about daylight savings time's effects on our sleep. Right now, it's time for our weekly Wisconsin News Roundup, checking in with reporters around the state about what they've been covering. First, the president of St. Norbert College in De Pere announced last week that he'll be resigning at the end of the academic year in June. That's left people asking for more details, and some are criticizing the school's board. Haley Biemiller is a local government reporter for the Green Bay Press-Gazette. Haley, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, Friday, Haley, Brian Breeze made this announcement that he'd be leaving this job. Unexpectedly, people thought, after 3 years, what do we know and not know about why he's leaving?
So right now, we don't know much. We know he is expected to finish out the academic year, so he will be leaving June 30th. His announcement did not provide any specific reasoning why he's leaving, and the board has not offered specific details either.
And this week, a group of students apparently demonstrated on campus asking for answers. Some were supporting the outgoing president. What kind of things did they bring up?
The initial student reaction to Breese's announcement was definitely a shock. He's very well respected among students. They consider him to be someone who reaches out and really participates in the community. And, no one was expecting him to announce that. And now there are concerns that the board is not being transparent about why he's leaving. And, at this point, they just want more answers and more transparency from administration.
And one of Breeze's predecessors as president of St. Norbert College got into the conversation this week with an open letter to the St. Norbert College board. What did he bring up?
Yeah, he sent a letter to the Board of Trustees that the campus newspaper, the St. Norbert Times, was able to get a copy of. And in that letter, he called the process secretive and abrupt, and criticized the board for not being transparent and not giving Breeze the opportunity to defend himself. He acknowledged that he generally tries to stay out of college business at this point, but he said that he wanted to share his disappointment, and mentioned as well that he was afraid that they have put the college at risk by doing this.
Had there been any controversial issues on the St. Norbert campus that people are maybe speculating might have anything to do with this?
So last year, there was an investigation into the college's response to sexual assault investigations on campus. Many students and alumni felt that administration was not properly following Title IX procedures. There was a suggestion in some cases that they were covering up sexual assault reports. And many of those allegations were tied to the Reverend Jay Faulkner, who is currently on sabbatical, but at that time he was the vice president for mission and student affairs. So at this point, the college has said that discussions about Breeze's departure did not involve Faulkner's status with the school, but again, because of a lot of the mistrust that exists on campus right now, some students have speculated that may be part of it.
And Haley, as we wrap up, what are you watching for next?
We are waiting to hear some more information from the board, and just today, in fact, the executive committee of the board issued a statement to the campus community saying that Breeze's decision is a private personnel matter and all parties have agreed to respect the privacy of that information. So, we will keep an eye out for more statements from the college and, more information from students or more actions by students as they continue to push for answers.
Haley, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Haley Biemiller is a local government reporter at the Green Bay Press Gazette. She joined us to talk about the president of St. Norbert College announcing he'll leave the job in June unexpectedly. Next, we head to La Crosse, where the police department has a new policy requiring political campaigns to cover half of their costs before holding speeches or rallies in the city. Hope Kerwin is a reporter for WPR News based in La Crosse. She joins us from our studio there. Hope, welcome back.
Happy to do it.
Why is the La Crosse Police Department saying they want money up front?
Yeah, so they are saying that they're going to require a 50% deposit of the expected security services up front because they had three events that they never received payment for the added security that they provided.
Yeah, what were those events?
Yeah, so the invoices that were sent were for two events from President Donald Trump's campaign. One was a rally held by Vice President Mike Pence, and one was a visit by President Trump for a private fundraiser in La Crosse. The other was for former House Speaker Paul Ryan's. He did a bus tour across the state and stopped in La Crosse in November of 2016.
And people might not think of local police playing a role, but these high-profile visits can generate expenses for local police departments?
Absolutely. And La Crosse police were very clear in that they're only asking these campaigns to provide to pay for wages for the officers that are overtime wages for the officers that are providing security for these events. Nothing more.
Any word on how this would be enforced, Hope?
Yeah, so I actually just got word this morning from an assistant chief at the La Crosse Police. He says that if campaigns don't provide this 50% deposit up front, that the police department will not provide extra officers for security and that campaigns will then have to rely on their own security for their events.
This is coming from La Crosse, Hope, and your piece on this, you wrote about other communities having unpaid bills as well. What kind of things did you see?
Yeah, I was able to confirm that the city of Green Bay and the city of Eau Claire police departments are in similar situations. They had events that were that they billed presidential campaigns for these overtime wages and never received payment.
And you mentioned the ones in La Crosse were Republican campaigns, but it turns out when you look elsewhere, this is a bipartisan issue sometimes.
Yeah, I did. I was able to confirm that former Democratic presidential candidate Hillary Clinton's campaign also has some unpaid police services bills in the state.
Are there still efforts to get the old 2016 campaigns to pony up for local governments?
As far as La Crosse goes, they said that they are just hoping to look forward now. They're not focusing on these outstanding bills, but are just hoping to put this policy in place so they're not stuck in a similar situation where they're on the hook for these overtime wages.
Are the police in La Crosse expecting, I guess anybody in La Crosse, expecting to be a busy stop for candidates this election season?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the police official that I talked to said, you know, we in La Crosse have been seeing presidential stops since the 2012 campaign, at least. You know, last year, in addition to the events that I mentioned, Clinton's campaign visited. Senator Bernie Sanders also visited the La Crosse area. So we're definitely a stop on the route and expected to be just as busy in 2020.
Hope, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
That's Hope Kerwin, WPR reporter based in La Crosse. She talked with us about the city police department in La Crosse having a new policy that would require political campaigns to cover about half the cost of security before they hold events there. Now, a Green Bay company is working on a project that would convert manure into renewable energy, but the state's Public Service Commission is sending it through another round of reviews before giving it their stamp of approval. Danielle Kading is a WPR reporter based in Superior. Danny, thanks for joining us again.
Thanks, Rob.
Well, tell us about this project, a big project, it sounds like, to convert manure into natural gas in Brown County.
Yeah, this is a $66 million project. And as you said, it's going to convert manure into energy. Basically, they're going to capture gas that's produced by manure, otherwise known as methane, and use that to produce renewable natural gas that would be injected into a natural gas pipeline.
That sounds like a long process, and it hit a bit of a snag when they had to relocate. What happened there?
Yeah, because they've been working on this for 2 years. You know, the state approved $15 million for this a couple years ago. And the snag was that they had to change the location because the town of Holland, where they originally sited it, decided that they weren't going to award a permit for the project. So now they're in a different town. And because of that, that change in location, it changed the scope of the project, which means that they're going to be using more manure and they're going to be using more farms. And they're also going to be changing the way they treat the water, or they're going to be using different equipment. So those are a couple of the things that changed with this project.
And the state gave some money here, but they had guidelines on things like water quality. You mentioned what other kind of factors and conditions was the state initially looking at that they might have to revisit now with this new, slightly changed project?
Yeah, well, when they originally put out this request for proposals for people to access this funding to do this kind of work, they wanted to see several things. They wanted to see it meet some water treatment goals, goals on nutrient management and renewable energy production, and also reduce pathogens getting into the waterways in that area because, as you know, it's kind of sensitive to contamination because of that fractured bedrock in northeastern Wisconsin. So they're going to go back now and rescore this proposal to make sure it fits with the original goals.
And they, in this case, the decider we're waiting for is the Public Service Commission. Is that right?
Yeah. And so what's going to happen is that this work group of state agencies, including the DNR and the Wisconsin Department of Ag, they're going to go back and take a look at this and make sure that it fits with the criteria that was originally intended when they awarded funding for this project.
If everybody gives a thumbs up or if there are slight changes needed, when could this thing be up and running, are people saying?
Well, the company would like, BC Organics would like to see this up and running by 2021, and they're hoping to start construction next year.
What's the next step you're watching for? You mentioned a whole bunch of state agencies signing off on this one.
Yeah, so they're going to review it, and the goal is to have it reviewed by the end of December. And then it would be up to the commission as to whether or not it meets the standards that were set out.
We'll watch for that next step. Danny, thanks a lot.
Yeah, thanks, Rob.
Danielle Kading is a WPR reporter based in Superior. She talked with us about the state's Public Service Commission sending a Brown County project to convert manure into renewable energy back to a review stage. Coming up, we'll talk about daylight saving time and the impact it has on our sleep and our health. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, former President Barack Obama recently criticized what many people call cancel culture. We'll hear two perspectives on whether it hurts or helps dialogue in a polarized country. First, the clocks fell back an hour this Sunday, marking the end of daylight saving time. Love it or hate it, daylight saving time will continue to be a federal rule, meaning we'll lose the hour we just gained in the spring and get it back again later. The loss and gain of that hour is more than a logistical headache for many people. It can also have an impact on our health. Studies show that our cognitive function is impaired around the time change, and there can be higher rates of serious emergencies like heart attacks. Our next guest breaks down the health impacts of daylight saving time. Paul Martino is the chair and associate professor in the Department of Biology at Carthage College in Kenosha. Paul, welcome to Central Time.
My pleasure.
Well, we just fell back an hour, so in my opinion, we gained an hour. But that might not be a good thing, this change of schedule. Why is that?
The problem is that when you throw off the circadian rhythms, the sleep cycle, it makes people groggy for different reasons. So even though we gained an hour, the body has this internal clock and it likes the clock to be on time. And so when the clock is not on time, it senses that there's a problem and people get groggy.
What kind of consequences can there be to doing this, say, a couple times a year?
So the falling back in the fall isn't as much of a problem, but so the consequences in the spring are greater because what the research shows is that there are a greater number of accidents, heart attacks, and some other bad things could happen because of a cognitive impairment in the spring. That doesn't seem to be quite the case in the fall.
In my head, it feels like just an hour. It doesn't seem like that big a deal, but our body's rhythm says, yeah, it is?
Yeah, the body's rhythm says, yeah, it is. So there are these clocks, the clock genes, and the master clock is in the brain in an area called the hypothalamus. It's called the suprachiasmatic nucleus. And in addition to the major clock, there are additional clocks, and they're extremely sensitive to changes in time. For instance, when you fly from the West Coast to the East Coast, right, that's jet lag. And, let's say you fly from Wisconsin, which is Central Time, to New York. You lose an hour, and you feel that hour when you lose it.
Is this a big enough worry to you? I know people have been arguing about daylight savings time for decades. Is this something where you think just solely because of the possible health concerns, we should revisit this idea and weigh these costs against whatever the benefits might be?
That's a tough question. I think it's something to consider. Like I said, the fall doesn't seem to be as big of an issue, but in the spring it does become bigger, and there is literature to support this, that we do have these unintended consequences. So it's probably something we should think about. Many other countries don't do this, and we don't see some of the same changes that occur in countries that do it. So it's at least something to have a conversation about.
We're talking about daylight savings time and our sleep patterns with Paul Martino, chair and associate professor in the Department of Biology at Carthage College in Kenosha. Paul, there's this nagging concern at the back of my head now. I often stay up later on the weekends and get up later on the weekends. I suspect I'm not the only American to do this. Are we voluntarily messing with our own sleep cycles in ways that it might be bad for us?
In fact, you are. The best option would be to go to sleep and wake up relatively around the same times. And the body seems to benefit from habits. And so when you start changing your sleep-wake cycle, you're essentially doing what happens during daylight savings time, and it's probably exacerbated compared to daylight savings times because we're not just doing it by an hour. We're probably looking at several hours. So, yeah, we're doing exactly what you said.
Do we, looking at this as a biologist, do we as, I'll just say Americans, I don't know what the rest of the world is doing, do we take our sleep seriously enough in the biology of our sleep?
I don't think we do. So if you look back in our own history, in the 1930s and 40s, average American was probably getting closer to 9 hours of sleep. And that's probably because we were more agrarian-based and light played a more important role, and we didn't have all of the technology that we have now. So I don't think we take it seriously enough. I think sleep is one of those things that, oftentimes you'll hear people say, I'll sleep when I die, and that's their attitude because sleep is a secondary thing. But if you take a look at the consequences of lack of sleep on the immune system, on your gut biota, on your cognitive abilities, on your endocrine system, your hormonal system, right? All of those, including your metabolism, all of those function suboptimally when we don't get enough sleep, and that's probably between 7 to 9 hours a night.
That's all stuff that's affecting us in the short run. If I'm not sleeping on a good schedule or enough, I'm feeling it tomorrow or this week. Are there long-term cumulative impacts of not taking care of our sleep?
There actually are. And it's all of those things that I've mentioned become cumulative. So in the metabolism, our ability to regulate blood glucose, the sugar that gives us energy, becomes severely impaired over time, and that's just from not sleeping. So the difference between someone who sleeps 8 hours a night and someone that sleeps 5 hours a night is statistically significant. And so if you magnify that three-hour gap in sleep over a year or two, you can imagine the consequences of it, where someone could become diabetic.
As a biologist who's looking at sleep, what are some of the things we don't know? What are some of the frontiers you'd like to have more information about?
Sure. Some of the things we don't know about sleep is, how exactly do we get better? So I like to think about sleep as a soft reboot for all of the systems, but we're not exactly sure how that works, right? We know that it does, because the data show it, but how does it happen? Is it happening in the brain? Does every organ system that has these clocks, these circadian clocks, get affected individually? So it'd be interesting to see if it's not just the major clock genes, but the more minor.
Wow. Okay. And scientists are researching these kind of things as we speak, I imagine.
They are. Yeah. They are. And so hopefully within the next 3 to 5 years, we'll have some of those answers.
Now, if I can ask a personal question, you're a biologist, you know this stuff all pretty well. Does that mean you keep up a pretty good sleep habit, or are you like the rest of us and kind of jump around?
I will be honest. I try to. I'm better over the last 5 years than I was when our children were younger. So I try to go to bed and sleep 7 to 8 hours a night and do that on the weekends too. But I'll be honest, it's really tough. And so there is evidence to show now that you can catch up on sleep on the weekends. So that's at least encouraging.
Knock is on
that
wood, you, yeah.
Yeah.
And as we wrap up, let's go back to that clock change now. We're about a week out from it, just shy of a week out. Are there things we can do to help recover when we change the clock in the fall and maybe especially when it comes up again in the spring?
Absolutely. So go to bed at your normal hour, number one. Number two, if you can be exposed to lots of sunlight early in the morning, 10 to 15 minutes, number two. Number three is try to do some kind of physical activity early in the morning. And number four, be patient, because unfortunately there are just some things that take time.
Paul, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for sharing this with us.
You're very welcome. My pleasure.
Paul Martino is the chair and associate professor in the Department of Biology at Carthage College in Kenosha. He joins us to talk about the impact of daylight saving time on our health and about good sleep hygiene in general. Coming up, so-called call-out culture has a lot of people sharing their passionate opinions and criticisms online, but there's a lot of pushback, too. We'll get two takes on the value of online outrage. And, by the way, keep up with WPR's podcast series Derailed, tracking the rise and fall of high-speed rail here in Wisconsin, hearing from a lot of the key players, political figures, and more in that story. Find it at WPR.org/derailed or wherever you like to get your podcasts. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up Monday at 7 on The Morning Show, gun laws are in the news lately here in Wisconsin. Keely Baltina and her guest look at recent claims on gun issues and fact-checking of those claims. That's Monday morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. Now, former President Barack Obama gave a talk last week. In part of it, he criticized what some people call cancel or call-out culture, when someone is publicly, often online, called out for saying something perceived as offensive. Here's a listen.
You know, this idea of purity and you're never compromised and you're always politically woke and all that stuff, you should get over that quickly. The world is messy. There are ambiguities. People who do really good stuff have flaws.
The comments got some praise, especially from conservative pundits who have long been critical of the practice. Among some on the left, the reception was mixed at best. Loretta Ross is an activist and a visiting associate professor in the Program for the Study of Women and Gender at Smith College in Massachusetts. She wrote an op-ed in the New York Times back in August before these comments titled, "I'm a Black Feminist. I think call-out culture is toxic." Her forthcoming book is called Calling In the Calling-Out Culture, Detoxing Our Movement. Loretta, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me on your show.
Well, I want to play a little more of what former President Obama said about this last week. Here's a little more of a taste of that.
Like if I tweet or hashtag about how you didn't do something right or used the word wrong verb, or then I can sit back and feel pretty good about myself because, man, you see how woke I was? I called you out.
So you wrote about this, again, before this address. What do you think about what the former president had to say there?
I thought the president was spot on, even though I think he was a bit dismissive, because call-out culture is very useful for holding people in authorities and with power to account. But at the same time, most call-outs are horizontal, where people are criticizing each other for not being woke enough. And that's what I think President Obama was referring to, the search for political purity when it doesn't even exist.
And for some people listening, they know all about what we're talking about. They're online all the time and they see this happening in real time. But for some of our listeners who aren't as online all the time, and I envy them a little bit, can you explain a little more about what we mean when we say things like cancel culture or call out culture?
Well, call out or cancel culture is criticizing people for what they believe or what they think that you don't think that they should do or believe. It's kind of, we all make judgments about each other. That's what human beings do. But when we choose to publicly shame somebody as a way of correcting them, that's called a call out. And that can happen on the right or the left. This is not a partisan issue. It's a courtesy rudeness kind of issue, because if you think someone has done something wrong, you can actually pull them aside privately and tell them, or you can call them out, shame them, and make them walk on eggshells forever for fear of putting the wrong foot forward again. It's a choice that we make in about how we deal with holding people accountable and work towards bringing people together in more civil unity rather than just bitterness and frustrations and accusations.
In your piece, The New York Times, you write that you've faced the temptation of joining in on call-outs before there was even an internet. Can you talk about how you've seen this as a challenge in your own career?
Well, I'm a rape and incest survivor, so of course I don't have a lot of patience for people who tend to think that it's okay to violate women or children. And so that's my first reflex, to want to call them out, hold them accountable. But also, as a young activist in my 20s, I ran a D.C. rape crisis center. And we actually worked with men who had been incarcerated for raping and murdering women. And it got to a point that once you actually see the humanity of perpetrators, of people that you probably wouldn't want to bring home for coffee, you can't hate them anymore. You can't objectify them. And even when I was, one time I was actually in Wisconsin, in La Crosse, Wisconsin, helping to deprogram someone who'd been in the Ku Klux Klan, Ken and Carol Peterson. And once I got to know them, I couldn't even hate people in the Klan. And when a black woman can't hate the Klan, I mean, your hate list gets really, really short. And so I've learned that I can have difficult conversations with maybe some undeserving people without getting into the call-out culture.
That sounds hard. More power to you for being able to do that. But it assumes the ability to have a lot of grace for someone to accept someone, to reach out to someone who is perpetrating something directly against them.
Well, it was something I had to grow to, because it ain't easy and it ain't automatic. I mean, I started out as mouthy and know-it-all as any other young person when I became an activist. But thank goodness the elders in the civil rights and women's rights movement didn't give up on insufferable me. They gave me the grace to learn from my mistakes. And now that I'm an elder in my late 60s, I want to offer these lessons to other young people to know that it starts with being accountable for your own mistakes and learning to forgive yourself for your own mistakes. And once you do that, you're in a better place to forgive others for not knowing what you know or for their mistakes.
Talking to Loretta Ross, talking about call-out culture or cancel culture. It's big online. She says there can be a better way. And you write about in this piece, and I think in your forthcoming book, the idea of call-in culture. What do you mean by that?
Calling in means putting a pause on something that you think is wrong, and just stopping and asking a question of inquiry. You can just say, you know, when you said that, could we talk more about what you meant? Or, I think I heard you say this, but I'm not sure if I heard you correctly. Can you tell me more? Instead of going on full blast reaction and saying, when you said that, or when you didn't get my pronoun right, or when you didn't use this right word, I think you are whatever you're going to call, name you're going to call them. So it's not about evading accountability. It's just choosing a more humane and human rights-centered way of seeking accountability that doesn't humiliate people, doesn't hold them up for public shunning, doesn't identify them as someone we can comfortably hate. Because that's part of the problem. The call-out culture says, it's all right to hate these people, because we're going to join in hating them because of what they think, did, or do. You know, that kind of thing. That's just mob behavior. And it doesn't even make for good politics, because it's really critical that we unite against those people who would deny us our human rights instead of quibbling with our allies that we should be working with.
You said at the outset, you're mostly talking about at the horizontal level, maybe people on the same plane as we are. But you said there's a lot of room for calling out people in power. What different rules might apply in that situation?
Well, you use call outs for people in power because that's sometimes the only way to get their attention. I mean, the protesters around Standing Rock, for example, with the oil pipeline, they had tried a number of ways to stop that pipeline, and they had to go to public call out and public shaming in order to get national attention to the fact that millions of people's lives were imperiled by the pipeline. I think the Me Too movement was a call out movement, still is a call out movement, because some people were unreachable and could not be held accountable, like R. Kelly or Harvey Weinstein. I mean, there were people that simply were not going to be held accountable and had gotten away with violating others for years and years and years. So I think when you're punching up, so to speak, that's when call outs can be most useful. But most people are either punching sideways or punching down through call outs. And that's what I critique.
Talking to Loretta Ross, an activist and visiting professor at Smith College in Massachusetts. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think, if you're online a lot, what do you think of this idea of call-out culture or cancel culture? When you see people disagree with you online, do you ignore? Do you confront? Do you converse? How do you treat these disagreements, maybe with someone with a worldview that you think is maybe harmful to yourself or others? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We pick up our conversation about what some people call cancel culture or call-out culture, online confrontations over issues we disagree on. Some say it's a new kind of activism that the younger generation is using. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you witnessed this in action? Been on the participating or receiving end of angry denunciations online? Have you called someone out online, or have you tried to reach out online to someone you disagree with? Call 800-642-1234, or in person. I guess we still communicate that way too. 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Loretta Ross stays on the line with us, and we'll add a new voice to the conversation now. Ernest Owens is a writer-at-large for Philly Magazine. He also wrote a piece in the New York Times titled Obama's Very Boomer View of Cancel Culture. Ernest, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me on.
We'll talk a little bit about your reaction to what former President Obama had to say when he was criticizing this idea of cancel culture.
Well, for starters, I do have the utmost respect for the former president. One of his greatest strengths, and I think some of his weaknesses, is that he tries to find common ground. And in certain situations, trying to find common ground can require you to simplify some of the most complex and nuanced things. And when it comes to cancel culture, I think that Obama oversimplifies what's actually happening with young people in these types of dynamics. And I also think he misplaces a lot of the blame on the nastiness of cancel culture on young people, when it's really a cross-generational issue that we're seeing. I think one of the most notorious people on social media is someone that's a boomer, and he's the current president of the United States, and he's kind of fledged a culture of trolls on the internet that are not my age group. I'm 28 years old, and the type of people that are on there, you know, professing these types of viewpoints and disrupting a lot of the great, positive, and necessary movement work that young people are helping to amplify are getting distracted by the vitriol that is happening by other generations on the internet. So I really think that Obama made some salient points, but they were misplaced and pretty much irrelevant to what young people are actually doing online on social media and what the real, you know, progress has happened because of it.
And former President Obama also suggested that people are doing online activism instead of, I think, the real thing. I'm paraphrasing here. You write that you see social media as a tool that younger generations are using in a positive way.
Absolutely. Obama would have not been elected had it not been for young people and this generation, my generation, using social media to spread out his message and to really challenge society's notions of what it means for diversity and inclusion in the Oval Office. A lot of his message about hope and change was being transmitted through YouTube videos and through social media platforms that no other president before him had really utilized in the same way. So I find it rather hypocritical of him to now kind of criticize or to dismiss the same grassroots social media activism and awareness that my millennial generation and had used to help him get elected.
And Ernest, as we wrap up, do you think there's room, as Loretta Ross is talking about, for reaching out to someone, even if they're expressing something you very much disagree with, maybe violently disagree with, to try to find common ground?
I think the biggest misperception is that that is happening. And to be quite honest, we have to remind ourselves that young people are oftentimes the most vulnerable. And they're in situations where they have to think before they leap. And so I would tell you that anytime I stepped up to a person of power on social media, I thought about the scarce job market and opportunities and retaliation I could face. And a lot of young people are having to make those decisions every day. So I think we already know what is up at grass. And I think it's really our parents and people of power who have to really think about that proper etiquette, because young people are the most vulnerable when it comes to these types of dynamics. And we also think about the ramifications as follows.
Ernest, thanks a lot for being with us today.
Thank you.
That's Ernest Owens, journalist with Philly Magazine. He wrote in the New York Times about cancel culture in response to President Obama. Loretta Ross also wrote about this. Let's bring you back in, Loretta. What do you think, hearing from someone in the younger generation spelling out how he views social media and the idea of cancel culture?
Well, we have to separate the tool of social media from how it actually gets used. I don't think Ernest was correct in saying that it's a generational issue. I mean, we had our call outs for every time there's a pluralistic debate in society. That's what pluralism is. We critique each other. We try to hold each other's ideas up to scrutiny, and we decide. I mean, the whole definition of call out was a duel. I mean, so we are always in a society of call out. The question that I'm asked is, to what end? When we choose to call out problematic allies with whom we should be working and figuring out how to create common ground, I think it's a bit short-sighted when we actually should be uniting in the face of actual opponents. I think the civil rights movement was full of people who disagreed with each other and called each other out, but they knew when to strategically come together in the face of white supremacy. The women's movement, we're not all feminists in the same way. We all have different definitions of feminism, but we know when to come together in the face of patriarchy. And so I think what's happening is that the pursuit of unity is somewhat being understated because people are really pursuing being proven right.
Let's bring on a caller now. Sorry, go ahead.
And that's what I think is a problem.
Let's bring on a caller. Bob joins us now in Madison. Bob, hello.
Yeah. Thanks for taking my call. I called out a friend on Facebook yesterday. He posted a joke that was just a little too edgy, and in my self-righteous fashion, I commented in a way that called him out. And he took the post down, but listening to Loretta makes me think that I really should have contacted him privately.
Interesting, Bob. What do you think, Loretta? When do we confront publicly, say online, versus sending a private message or having a chat later?
You confront people publicly when you're accomplishing another goal. You challenge people privately when you actually want them to change the behavior. Okay? And so confronting people publicly signals how woke you are, how virtuous you are, how on top of things you are. That's a different goal than talking to someone who's a Facebook friend and saying privately, can we meet over coffee or whatever and talk about this and maybe get some behavior change? It's not about letting whatever the offense was get a pass. It's what is the outcome you want from holding them accountable.
Bob, thank you so much for calling in and sharing that anecdote. I appreciate that. At 800-642-1234. Monty joins us now in Viroqua. Monty, hi.
Hi there. Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. One thing I've been paying attention to is I believe it's the energy of the call out itself is very important. And what I'm trying to say is when a call out is based on hatred, I don't think it's effective. And it seems like there's so much hatred in our culture right now, flying all over the place. It just does not lend itself to really making progress. So, I mean, that's my personal philosophy on it.
Monty, thanks for the call. Loretta, what do you think? He thinks people are leading, maybe publicly or privately, with a hateful attitude.
Well, frankly, excuse me, a call in is a call out done with love. So he's absolutely right. When you call out through anger and hatred, you're publicly shaming somebody. But when you call in with love, you're offering grace, forgiveness, and love as a way to get them to think more deeply about what they're doing.
Thanks so much for that call. Loretta, you've been watching how we talk about politics and issues over a lot of years. Are we getting more hateful, argumentative, combative in our communications, or does it just feel that way sometimes when we spend too much time online?
I think the virality of social media makes it feel a lot worse to us. But as an African-American woman who did not have to get spit on in order to go to public schools, it's kind of hard for me to say it's worse now than what people went through in the 50s and the 60s when they couldn't sit at lunch counters or they got beaten for trying to vote or things like that. So I don't want to be so self-absorbed with our time that we make somehow shift and forget how bad people had it before. We actually are getting better. It doesn't feel like that because, I mean, look who we have in the White House who has unleashed the hounds of hatred. But at the same time, that's the last gasp of a dying set of people who want to refight the Civil War, and they're not going to win.
In our last few moments, Loretta, leave us with some advice when we have that gut reaction to want to fight online or in person.
Stop and take a deep breath and do an internal temperature check to see if you're in a space to offer people grace and love. And if you're not in that space, go on, do something else. Don't feed the trolls. Don't feed your own hatred, because really all it's going to do is rebound on you anyway and make you feel worse, and certainly won't correct whatever you're calling out.
Loretta, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me on your show.
That's Loretta Ross, an activist and visiting associate professor with Smith College in Massachusetts. She has a book forthcoming on call-out culture. She was with us today to talk about what she thinks is wrong with what's called cancel or call-out culture, mostly online and elsewhere, and some better ways to have dialogue with people we disagree with, even people we disagree with a lot. Coming up Monday on Central Time, Wisconsin Attorney General Josh Call joins the show for a look at efforts to pass new gun laws in Wisconsin and at the state's participation in a federal lawsuit on conscience exemptions for healthcare workers. We'll find out how businesses in the tax filing industry may have influenced rules that make it harder for taxpayers to file for free. And Wisconsin's Horicon Marsh is a hot spot for nesting and migrating birds. And this year saw a historic number of feathered friends in the area. We'll get the details and find out what kinds of birds made an appearance there in 2019. That and look at some of the top news stories of the day. It's all coming up Monday here on Central Time.